Evening, everyone. It's good to see you all. I thought we'd start off by just thinking briefly about what makes us all different. Well, there's lots of things, isn't there, really? You know, our age, the colour of our skin, the colour of our eyes, the colour of our hair, the things we wear, all sorts of things. Even regional accents. And I have to say, I was in Scotland last week, and I went up to Aberdeen, and I thought, we were in Britain still. But I have to say, I spent 10 minutes in this taxi with this taxi driver, and I'm sure he wasn't speaking English. And, I was just nodding away, and he was... but he was. He was Scottish. We were so different. And I think I got away with it. I just nodded in the right places. But, but that's what makes us different, doesn't it? We're all so different, aren't we? I think it'd be fair to say that I think we like to be different, don't we? We like to express our individuality. And sometimes we like to stand out in the crowd, don't we? By the things we wear, by the house we live in, by the car we drive. All these sorts of things express our own individuality, don't we? So, as I say, sometimes we want to be different and to stand out. And of course, it was a long time ago when I remember people walking around like this. They don't do so much nowadays. But, hairstyles were a clear indication of your individual expression. And I think people still like to be individuals, don't they? But of course, being different sometimes isn't a good thing, is it? It can have all sorts of different connotations, like prejudice and racism and things like that. And some of you will perhaps remember or recognise this patch which the Jews had to wear during the time of the Nazis, just before and during the Second World War. The Jews were herded together, weren't they, in ghettos and then later in concentration camps. And the Nazis made them wear this badge to show that they were different, or to try and show that they were different. And they were treated, worse than animals, weren't they? And exterminated by the Nazis. And so sometimes it's not good to be recognised as being different, is it? It has some very serious connotations. So none of us want to be, yes, we want to be an individual, we want to be recognised as an individual, but we don't want to be singled out, do we, or victimised for being different to everybody else. Now, what about a dare? Well, a dare, it's a strange thing, isn't it? If I dare you to be different, is it in a good way or is it in an uncomfortable way? Because really the very notion of a dare probably means sort of stepping outside your comfort zone, doesn't it? I could perhaps dare you to do a bungee jump, and yes, that would take courage, wouldn't it? And it probably wouldn't be the something that you do every day. Really, we're meant to stand on the ground, aren't we? So really you think about jumping off a bridge or a cliff with a bit of rope attached to your ankle, it doesn't come naturally, does it? Or I perhaps could dare you to go, say, into the centre of Halifax and to stand on a box and to read something from our Bible on a Saturday morning. And you might be a little bit uncomfortable about that too, because that, once again, takes a different type of courage. And you might be singled out, mightn't you, for being different. I remember, when I was in my teens, we used to dare each other to do things. We used to say, at sixth form college, we used to dare each other to climb out the window, and we were on the third floor, and to shimmy along to the next window next and then go in and things like that. And so dares can be, at one stage they can be painfully embarrassing for you or for somebody else. But at worst, of course, a dare can be life-threatening as well. We used to do things that, if my mum and dad knew about them, oh dear, they'd be horrified. But, you know, that's what teenage boys do, isn't it? But I think all of us have got this, I suppose you could call it a daredevil mentality. We've all got this thing within us that sort of challenges convention. And you say, well, what is a devil? Well, you know, the standard sort of churches, most conventional churches would say, well, a devil is, you know, this being that will make you do bad things. And this is how it says in the dictionary. It says, it's the supreme spirit of evil, Satan, a subordinate evil spirit at enmity with God and having power to afflict humans both with bodily disease and with spiritual corruption. But, you know, that's nonsense, really, because really the true interpretation, especially when it talks about a devil in the Bible, the true interpretation of the Greek and Hebrew translation in our Bible simply means adversary, or someone that is in someone or something that is in opposition. So perhaps making you do something that is outside the normal course of things. So really, the opposing forces in the Bible are really very simple. When you actually look at it, it's God's way versus man's way. It's as simple as good versus evil, or good versus sin, or life versus death. They're really the opposing forces that we're talking about in the Bible. Just have a look. Let's just have a look right back in Genesis chapter 3. So I want to try and prove this, that we all have this sort of daredevil within us. We like to challenge convention. And it does go right back to Genesis chapter 3. Right back to the first man and the first woman that were created by God. And if we just read the first few verses from chapter 3, we see how this came about. So God's created this wonderful earth, and he's put Adam and Eve there. Really, I suppose you could say they were the pinnacle of his creation. And this is what happened. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. Then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. And then just finally, just look at verse 8. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. And we'll come back to that in a few minutes. So, that was right at the beginning, wasn't it? And I wonder if you've ever stopped to ask yourself, you know, what were Adam and Eve doing near the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Didn't she say to the serpent quite clearly, well, God has told us that we can't eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. You know, we can eat from any other tree. God had given Adam and Eve everything they could possibly want in life. And all he wanted them to do was to not eat from this tree. So why were Adam and Eve standing next to the tree of knowledge of good and evil? And you ask yourself this question, well, did the serpent actually make them sin? Well, you have to excuse me, this is only illustrative purposes only. It probably wasn't an apple, we don't know, but there you go. Adam and Eve, I would say, stood there. I think they probably went back on quite a regular basis to have a look at the fruit on that tree of knowledge of good and evil, because of this I suppose you could call it a bit of a self-destruct button that all of us have, don't we? This daredevil trying to oppose something that you know you really shouldn't be doing. Somebody's told you, don't do this, and you're curious to know why you shouldn't do it. So they'd go back, they'd take a good, long, hard look at that fruit that God had told them not to eat. And they'd keep going back and take another look and another look and another look. And of course, when the serpent comes up to them and says, oh, go on, take a bite, it'll be fine. It'll be fine, you'll become like God, you'll know good and evil. That's exactly what they did. And they succumbed to temptation. And unfortunately, we all have this inherent attitude, that's this sort of daredevil attitude, and we can all succumb to sin. I just wonder if anyone's ever been on a diet. You know, every so often I do Weight Watchers, and I've got this little calculator where I can add up, you know, how many calories and how many points I've done. It's brilliant if you ever want to lose weight, actually. And you basically tap it in, and it'll say, right, you should only be eating 25 points a day, and you know, so you get to sort of, you do all throughout the week, you stick rigidly to these 25 points, and you think, oh yeah, I think I'm losing a bit of weight here. And do you know what? The worst possible thing that somebody can say at the end of the week is, oh, do you fancy a bit of cake? You've done really well, haven't you, this week? You know, you've stuck to your 25 points every day, and you really deserve a bit of cake. And of course, this is what you've been thinking about cake all week, haven't you? Because you can't have any. And the worst thing is when somebody says, you really deserve a bit of cake. Well, and you think, yes, I do deserve a bit of cake. You know, I've been so good all week. I'm going to have a bit of cake. It really is the worst thing anybody could say. Well, let's just have a look at this. Just have a look at Daniel chapter 1. Now, we've already read a bit about Daniel, but this is the time in Israel's history when God had sent the nation of Babylon against the Israelites as basically as punishment for ignorance and for against God. They'd chosen to ignore God's blessings, and God sent Nebuchadnezzar and his army against the land of Israel and Judah in particular, and completely decimated the land. And he took with them, Nebuchadnezzar took the princes, the wise men, he took basically anything that was good out of the land of Israel, including all its gold and everything like that, and hauled them back to Babylon. But some of these men and women were still very faithful towards God, and Daniel and his friends were some of those men as well. They were clever men, and so Nebuchadnezzar put them into his court, and he was basically going to use their wisdom, but he was going to look after them at the same time. And so let's just have a read to see what happened to Daniel and his friends in verse 8. Basically, Nebuchadnezzar had said to his servants, look after these boys, you know, they could be useful, I suppose. That's what he was saying. He says, give them some good food and give them wine. And verse 8 it says, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favour and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who has appointed you food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are of your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel said to the steward of the chief of the eunuchs, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. And that's exactly what they do. He consented to that matter. And at the end of the 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Now, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't the sort of man who would take things lightly if you decided to go against his will. And the eunuch was obviously worried to say, look, Daniel, I didn't go against the king's commandments. He'll have my head off. And Daniel said, well, you know, give it a go and see. And the reason why Daniel and his friends were prepared to risk their lives, they dared to be different for the sake of God, was because if they had accepted the food and the wine that Nebuchadnezzar had offered them in Babylon, what else would they have been prepared to accept? You know, everybody else was doing it, and it would have been so easy, wouldn't it, for Daniel and his friends to think, well, you know, we've been hauled off to Babylon, you know, when in Rome or when in Babylon, do as the Babylonians do. It would have been so easy, and that's what a lot of the Israelites actually did. They got very accustomed to the lifestyle in Babylon. But Daniel and his friends stuck rigidly to their principles, and they wouldn't accept the food and the drink which Nebuchadnezzar had to offer. Then just go over a few pages, and we read about some of those friends, some of Daniel's friends, in chapter 3. And the time, when Nebuchadnezzar set up an image. Nebuchadnezzar had a pretty big ego, and he'd got a lot of gold that he'd plundered from the lands that he'd invaded, and he decided to make a big image of himself so that people could bow down to it. And of course we've read the account, haven't we? When the music played, everybody had to bow down and worship this golden idol. And Nebuchadnezzar was incensed when he found out that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego weren't going to bow down like everybody else to this image. And he hauls them up, doesn't he, before him and his court, and says, you know, what do you think you're doing? You know, you should obey my commandments. I don't care what God you believe in. You obey me and you follow the crowd. And of course, that was their reply. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us. Because, of course, Nebuchadnezzar says, right, you're going into the fiery furnace. But they didn't seem concerned, did they? They said, our God, who is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. So again, they were prepared to stand out from the crowd, to stick rigidly to their principles, regardless of the fact that everybody else around them was fearful of Nebuchadnezzar. Here was a man who could take their life away just like that. But they stuck to their principles because they believed and they had faith in God. So I would say that in this respect, standing out from the crowd can be difficult. Yes, it can be uncomfortable, and it can be even life-threatening in this case. But this is the thing. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, look, even if God doesn't save us from the fiery furnace, we'll still trust in him. We'll still believe in him. It might be his will that he will let us die in the fiery furnace. But we have something far better to look forward to. And they had absolutely nothing to fear, did they? They weren't scared of Nebuchadnezzar. And this was truly a scary man. And the same applies to us, I think, in our lives. You know, we have absolutely nothing to fear if we put God first in our lives. And sometimes that does mean standing out from the crowd, standing up for the things that we believe in, sticking to our principles. Even, and this is the key thing, even if it means going against the direction that everybody else seems to be going in. Just have a look at a few verses in Proverbs. The first one is early on in Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 3. verse 5. It says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil." And then it goes on to say in verse 23, "Then you will walk safely in your way, and your foot will not stumble. You will lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down, and your sleep will be sweet." And verse 26, "For the Lord will be your confidence, and will keep your foot from being caught." And then just have a look at chapter 4, and verse 14. "Do not enter the path of the wicked." This is talking about the direction that you should go in your lives. "Do not walk in the way of evil. Avoid it. Do not travel on it." Very clear instruction. And finally, over in chapter 16 and verse 25. And this is really summarizes everything. The two directions that we can take in life. "There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death." So, two very simple directions. And Proverbs refers to those different paths. Trust in the Lord, and he will direct your paths in life. Do not go down the path of the wicked. Even though everybody else seems to be following that way, it quite clearly says, don't go down there. Avoid it. Turn away from it. Because quite simply, one road will lead to life, and one road leads to death. But you know, when everybody is going in one direction, it's very easy, isn't it, to think, oh, am I going the right direction? You know, everybody else seems to be quite happy going in this direction. They seem to be having a good time. Everything seems to be pretty rosy. It doesn't seem to be that bad. It's very easy, isn't it, to follow the crowd, to do the things that everybody else around you is doing. But let's see what Jesus said about this. Just turn over to Matthew chapter 7. Very simple, two verses that really summarize these two directions that we have in life. Chapter 7 and verse 13. "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life. And there are few who find it." So, the broad, wide way seems very attractive. Probably seems the easy way. And note what Jesus says here, the narrow way, it's difficult. It's not an easy way. It does take courage. It takes conviction to go down that way because everybody else is going in the other direction. And there are very few people who find the way to life. But the very fact that you're here this evening means that Jesus has called you to take that narrow way to life. And I think, you know, every day we're confronted with choices, with decisions. And I have to say, you know, unfortunately, we'll meet a lot of people in our lives who want to lead us in the wrong direction. And they'll be very happy if we decide to say, oh yeah, I'll follow your direction. You know, if you haven't heard any of these yet, I can guarantee that one day in your life, you will hear them from somebody, whether it be school, university, work, wherever. You will hear this. What's the matter with you? Are you scared? Go on, it won't hurt you. Come on, just this once. I can't believe you've not done that yet. Go on, just try it. You really don't know what you're missing. These are just a few, and I would say I've probably heard them all. Choices, decisions, we have to make them every day. And it's very easy to make the wrong decision. So it's just like those people who offer you a piece of cake at the end of your Weight Watchers week, isn't it? You know, it's so tempting, isn't it? You do feel, oh, I've been good for the whole week. I'll just try it. You know, what harm can it do? These people, they want to give you an appetite for the things that they like to indulge in. But often it can be the way that leads to death. And this is what Peter says. We have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lewdness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Now, that word idolatry, you think, well, it's, you know, it was fine for in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. The idol was obvious, wasn't it? There it was, a nice big golden image of Nebuchadnezzar. You know, surely we're not going to bow down to any idols these days. Things like that just don't exist, do they? But what is idolatry? Well, actually, when you really look at it and boil it down to its base meaning, it just means worshipping anything other than God, putting things in front of God in your life. And if you actually really think about life today, you know, where are people today? They're probably at the shopping centres, restaurants, wherever, in their gardens, doing lots of other things, everything but worshipping God, are they? You know, we have so many idols that we can worship today in the 21st century, and people bow down to them quite easily. And we have to be careful that we don't fall into the same trap, and that we put these things first in our lives rather than putting the things of God first in our lives. And this is what Peter went on to say. In regard to these, they think it's strange, don't they? And I have to say, I know a few people who think it's strange that I go to church on a Sunday. How very odd. Or how very quaint, they say, that I go to church. And they think it's strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation and debauchery, speaking evil of you. Fortunately, they don't speak, well, I don't think they do, but they think it's strange that I go to church. But the Bible makes it very clear, doesn't it, about the directions we take in life. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Very clear. Don't be deceived by them. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor thieves, nor drunkards will inherit the kingdom of God. So, in conclusion then, how do we combat this problem of living in a world that, I would say, is largely opposed to the righteousness of God? Well, I think it really is a battle. It's a struggle. Every day of our lives, when we wake up, we should be there prepared to fight this battle and to stick to our principles. Peter again says we should be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. And prayer is a wonderful thing to help you through life. Because really, like Daniel and his friends proved, if God is on your side, then nobody can be against you. He will take care of you. He will guide you and direct you in your life. And of course, he will ultimately lead you to life in a kingdom that's going to be established here on earth when Jesus comes back to reign as king. Remember what they said, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego said to Nebuchadnezzar's threat. Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. We don't care how great or how important we think you are, Nebuchadnezzar. You know, you're nothing, really, in God's sight. God is all-powerful, and he can do whatever he wants. And of course, what did he do? He sent an angel, didn't he, there, to save them from the fiery furnace for Nebuchadnezzar to see. And I mentioned earlier, you know, when we looked at Genesis chapter 3, that when Adam and Eve were standing there looking at the tree of knowledge of good and evil, contemplating the fruit, it says they were there on their own, weren't they? They'd left God for some reason. They were there, standing there, looking at the tree, contemplating that fruit that God had told them not to eat, and they were sitting there thinking about whether they should eat it or not. And that's when they succumbed to temptation, because God wasn't with them. Because in verse 8 it says, they heard God walking, didn't they, in the garden. And they hid because they were ashamed of what they'd done. But when you think about Jesus, and you think the life that he lived, he always had God beside him every step of the way. He overcame every single temptation known to man, didn't he? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. And ultimately, he gained victory over sin and death because he achieved what none of us is able to achieve in our lives. And he suffered for us because he had the courage, didn't he, to be different, to stand up for what he believed in, to trust in God always. And so if we're going to win the battle, we have to follow Christ's example in our lives. We're told that he is the captain of our salvation. And so we shouldn't be lowering our standards. And, you know, that term comes from a battle way back when armies used to fight together. If the standard bearer, he was holding the flag of the side that was in battle, if he fell, somebody else would pick up the standard, lift it up to show that you were still in the fight, that, you know, the battle wasn't lost. That's why we shouldn't lower our standards to everybody else's standards around us. We have to show that whose side we're on. And hopefully you'll say that, yes, I am on God's side. I am on the Lord's side. So if we want to be on the Lord's side, as I say, let's raise our standards. Let's stand out from the crowd and dare to be different.